It's time now for the main body of tonight's installment of Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost a Second World War. And by the way, for those people who might consider the title of this program bombastic or preposterous, I in no way mean this figuratively, I mean it literally. Take a look at the world as it is and take a look at our position in it. We lost. The Axis won. What I'm looking at is how that happened, because it was a conquest not affected, for the most part, by force of arms, but rather by covert action. There were some force of arms involved, people like John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and a whole lot of other people will testify to that. But it was not a conquest by army groups blasting across borders. Rather, it was a conquest by political and espionage strategy. I guess you could say intelligence strategy. Now, one of the central concepts that should be borne in mind throughout the course of this entire program, and one of the central concepts that will figure this evening as we take a look at the formation of the Christian West concept. And as we shall see, that concept gave rise directly to NATO, and NATO itself, in the person of the Galen Organization, provided the vehicle for the entry of elements into the United States which were explicitly hostile to the United States and which affected the political conquest of the United States and economic conquest in particular, in conjunction with Native American fascist elements and the link-up between the American far right, the intelligence community and national security establishment, the defense industry, the petroleum industry, and the mainstream American political superstructure. That milieu that we looked at in our first two installments is, as I said, the milieu which is in control of this country today and is in control of the world's destiny. George Bush, as we looked at in our first installment, is part and parcel to that milieu. Now, one of the central concepts that should be borne in mind, we took a look at the formation of this last week, one of the central concepts, one of the main methodological considerations that should be looked at here in terms of examining the Third Reich, is how the German General Staff and the Nazi Party, and as we shall see also many of the industrialists and financiers that were in the Third Reich, learned to use the fear of communism, how they used anti-communism as a strategic vehicle for furthering their own ends. In Weimar Germany, in post-revolutionary Germany, the German General Staff, as well as the Nazi Party and many of the industrialists and financiers, learned that the fear of communism on the part of the victorious allies from World War I, the United States, Britain, and France, could be used to preserve the German General Staff and beyond that to further the imperial designs of Germany. And it is the strategic use of anti-communism, of the fear of communism, as a vehicle for conquest by the Third Reich and the elements that led into the Third Reich and the elements that came out of it. That concept, the strategic use of anti-communism as a vehicle for conquest, as a vehicle for, at first, as it was in the post-World War I period, the preservation of the German General Staff and the formation of the Nazi Party and the underground military organizations which gave rise to it. We looked last week, or we touched briefly, on how fear of communism was also used by the Third Reich as a vehicle for effecting some of its military conquests. The French army, for example, was surrendered by Maréchal Pétain, the Vichy fascist collaborator and hero of World War I. The French army was surrendered, quote, to preserve it, to save it, to fight communism. There were very powerful pro-fascist movements in many of the countries that the Third Reich conquered, and many of those fascist movements were used as what were known as fifth column elements. And the, again, part and parcel to the entire thesis, the operating thesis of Radio Free America 37, is the strategic use of anti-communism, of the fear of communism, as a vehicle for conquest. We're going to begin this evening by once again jumping back to World War II, and we're going to take a look at a very important, though largely unknown, book called The Nazis Go Underground. This was authored by an anti-fascist writer named Kurt Ries, R-I-E-S-S. It was copyrighted in 1944 and published in hardcover by Doubleday, Duran and Company. Kurt Ries was a very important anti-fascist writer whose work, unfortunately, like those the works of so many of his contemporaries were eclipsed, submerged, during the McCarthy period. What we're going to look at now is a section of the chapter in The Nazis Go Underground called Those Who Paid Hitler. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the plans of the German industrialists and financiers who supported Adolf Hitler, and we're going to take a look at their plans to, quote, go underground, unquote, and to survive the Third Reich and to continue after the inevitable military defeat of Germany. Recall that last week we saw how the German General Staff itself was preparing for what they saw as the inevitability of their own defeat by late 1941, with their failure to knock the Soviet Union out of the box, so to speak, in the first few months of their campaign. The German army had no plans to winter inside of the Soviet Union. By October of 1941, it was apparent to the German General Staff they were not going to be able to do that. And then by December 9th of 1941, with the Japanese having attacked Pearl Harbor and the American entry into World War II against Germany as well as Japan inevitable, the German generals began planning for their defeat. The Nazi Party itself began planning for defeat in a formal way by the spring of 1943 after the Battle of Stalingrad sealed the Third Reich's fate, even the minds of the SS and Nazi loyalists. What we're going to look at today is how the industrialists and financiers who backed Hitler, and as we have looked at in numerous archive shows, had very strong connections with industrialists and financiers around the world under the auspices of cartel agreements, and it should be noted, too, that many of their business partners were also very sympathetic to fascism, which they saw as the antidote to Bolshevism, and not only the threat of the Soviet Union proper, but the very powerful socialist movements in other countries as well. With the Great Depression on, socialism gained a great deal of sympathy and political following, which would be difficult for people in the United States to imagine at this time. There were, it should be remembered, at the end of World War I, abortive socialist revolutions in not only Germany, but many of the other countries in Europe as well, Eastern Europe in particular. And with the establishment of the first Marxist state, namely the Soviet Union, many of the world's industrialists and financiers were in a state of panic, and they saw fascism as the ideal antidote to Bolshevism or Marxism or communism, as we have come to call it in the second half of the 20th century. It should be noted, too, that as I have emphasized so often, one cannot separate fascism, Nazism in particular, from multinational corporate capitalism. Although they are not coterminous, at the same time, in examining the real history of fascism, one cannot fail to note, as many writers, notably George Seldes and others, have noted, that it is inextricably linked with multinational corporate capitalism, American corporate capitalism in particular. Now, in the chapter Those Who Paid Hitler, we're going to examine now how the German industrialists planned to go underground and how they planned to preserve themselves after the inevitable Nazi defeat. Kurt Ries writes as follows. From a long-range point of view, the industrialists are in the same boat with the Nazis. They can't afford the luxury of throwing the fascists out. They must sink or swim together, because if the Nazis don't come back, the industrialists' dreams of world domination will be ended once and for all. And, incidentally, business will never be so good as it used to be under Hitler. I would also interject at this point, one of the tenets of fascism has always been to crush unions and any form of labor organization as well. That obviously leads to greater profits. Continuing, what then can the German industrialists do to help the Nazis get back into power? They can go underground along with the Nazis. Of course, it is quite a different proposition for industry to go underground than for a party to do so. Perhaps it would be more exact to say that German industry from now on will have to lead a double life. This last sentence again for its key. Perhaps it would be more exact to say that German industry from now on will have to lead a double life. And the leading of that double life, as we shall see, led to the negotiations between Alan Dulles and German industrialists and financiers associated with the Canaris Group, as well as the transatlantic financial and industrial axis, which was central to the first two Radio Free America shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, etc. And again, those negotiations led to the Christian West concept, the seed concept for NATO. Continuing here. As far as the outside is concerned, or it should be here, there's a misprint. As far as the outside world is concerned, the industrialists will attend to their business and nothing else. But unofficially, they will go on collaborating with the outlawed Nazis. They will be very useful to the Nazi underground. They will find jobs for the many Nazis who must stay in Germany in order to attend to their subversive activities. They will find key positions for the key party men. They will finance the movement wherever and whenever it is necessary. In short, they will do for the Nazis exactly what they did for the nationalistic movements in the early 20s. All this may seem strange to a non-German observer, but German industrialists are strange men because they are obsessed men. A few days after the meeting at Krupp's residence, Herr von Schnitzler, S-C-H-N-I-T-Z-L-E-R, appeared in Madrid, having made the trip from Berlin in his own plane. He declared that he had escaped from Germany just ahead of the Gestapo, who were trying to arrest him. The statement was original, to say the least. For a man trying to escape from the Gestapo, Spain scarcely seemed a logical asylum. Switzerland or Sweden would have been much healthier places to repair to. And anyway, why should Herr von Schnitzler have had to fear the Gestapo, since his son-in-law, Herbert Schulz, was one of its leading officials? Schulz is S-C-H-O-L-Z. No, there is no reason to believe a word of what Baron Schnitzler said in those first interviews. I would interject at this point that von Schnitzler was one of the driving forces behind the IG Farben Chemical Company, the backbone not only of German war production, but also a key force in helping to finance the political rise of Adolf Hitler. Continuing. Schnitzler had always been rather popular, both nationally and internationally. After the Nazis came to power, it was frequently pointed out that the men in the IG Farben were not half so bad as the rest of the German industrialists, and decidedly not Nazis. Had Herr von Schnitzler not tried to keep his Jewish employees? And when he could do so no longer, had he not attempted to place them in IG Farben branches abroad? That was true. But it was also true that these Jews had made fortunes for IG Farben, and that it was good business to retain their services and also made for international goodwill, which any German firm during the 30s could well use. It may be that Schnitzler himself never became a member of the party, and it is quite certain that his predecessor, Dr. Karl Duisberg, D-U-I-S-B-E-R-G, definitely disliked the Nazis. But the president of the company, Hermann Schmitz, had financed Hitler and had been a member of the party for a long time, a fact which, incidentally, his American and English business friends knew very well. So much for Schnitzler's background. As for his trip to Madrid in the spring of 1943, it had no connection at all with his being hunted by the Gestapo. But it did have everything to do with the post-war plans of German industry. Skipping down, George von Schnitzler did not stay very long in Madrid. 3 weeks after his, quote, flight, unquote, he was back in Berlin again. Somehow, he must have made his peace with the Gestapo. More important, his mission was completed. Before he went back to Germany, he made an appearance in Lisbon, too. He met a few friends there, and familiarized them with certain, quote, changes of organization, unquote, which he said German industrialists were then contemplating. The details he gave showed how industry intended to carry through its plan of a faked divorce from Nazism. The last sentence again. The details he gave showed how industry intended to carry through its plan of a faked divorce from Nazism. To this end, von Schnitzler explained, German industry would fall back on its old pre-Hitler organization. The most important of the organizations, in fact, the center around which all future activities would be organized, would be the Deutsche Weltwirtschaftliche Gesellschaft, the German World Economic Society. That's spelled D-E-U-T-S-C-H-E, capital W-E-L-T-W-I-R-T-S-C-H-A-F-T-L-I-C-H-E, G-E-S-E-L-L-S-C-H-A-F-T. Continuing. This society had been formed in 1914, shortly before the outbreak of World War I, with the idea of establishing a contact between leaders of German industry and industrial leaders abroad. It was born too late to be of any particular help during World War I. German industrialists remained isolated then, except for a few friends in neutral countries. And after the war, during the years of the Weimar Republic, it was hardly heard from. But this state of affairs changed completely after Hitler came to power. It was chiefly General Karl Haushofer, a member of the Society since 1930, who devised an active and provocative policy for the Society and mapped out ways and means of using it for propaganda and industrial espionage. It turned out to be relatively easy to do this because the Deutsche Weltwirtschaftliche Gesellschaft dominated the German representatives in the International Chamber of Commerce, which in turn provided intimate contacts with industrialists of other countries. Certain industrialists who were members of this society, among them Friedrich Krupp von Bohlen-Halbach, Otto Peach, and Dr. Otto Fischer, chief of the Reichskreditgesellschaft, had been very busy since the summer of 1943 trying to figure out what the Deutsche Weltwirtschaftliche Gesellschaft could do to reorganize business affairs and disconnect them from the Nazis. This, according to Herr von Schnitzler, would be accomplished by an outward divorce from the Nazi Party and by replacing all the Nazi machines of industry by those machines and organizations which had existed before Hitler came to power, all of which, it was thought, should certainly prove to benevolent bystanders that everything was again as it used to be before Hitler. By the way, spellings, von Bohlen-Halbach, a Krupp, of course, is K-R-U-P-P-B-O-H-L-E-N-H-A-L-B-A-C-H, Otto Peach is P-I-E-T-Z-S-C-H, and Fischer, F-I-S-C-H-E-R. Skipping down once again, the intricate business of international cartels being what it is next to impossible to find out with absolute certainty exactly how much the non-German business associates of German industrialists knew about these plans and to what degree they are willing to cooperate in them. Last sentence again. The intricate business of international cartels being what it is next to impossible to find out with absolute certainty exactly how much the non-German business associates of German industrialists know about these plans and to what degree they are willing to cooperate in them. Certain only are these facts. German industrialists have been working constantly on plans which permit them to go underground in the way described above, that is, to put up a false front behind which nothing will change, the entire project having been conceived in closest collaboration with leading Nazi personalities and for their benefit. Bear that in mind. We're going to touch back on that later in the broadcast. Herr von Schnitzler, and as we shall see later, other representatives of German industries as well, have at least attempted to make contacts with their former business associates abroad in order to propose a close collaboration and even a partnership for the post-war period. That last sentence again, and again I'm repeating this because these are in many ways thesis statements for what we're going to be looking at, and this book again was written in 1944. Herr von Schnitzler, and as we shall see later, other representatives of German industries as well have at least attempted to make contacts with their former business associates abroad in order to propose a close collaboration and even a partnership for the post-war period. To what degree this proposed collaboration is already an accomplished fact while the war is still being fought is anybody's guess. But would it matter whether this collaboration started yesterday or will start the day after the armistice, so far as giving aid and comfort to the Nazis is concerned? Well, what we're going to begin looking at now is the extent to which just exactly this type of negotiation described by Kurt Reese in The Nazis Go Underground was in fact well underway even before 1944, and as we shall see, this partnership and collaboration did in fact, that union was in fact formed in this period, and again it was this contact and this union between the Nazi industrialists and financiers and their American and British, American in particular, counterparts in this transatlantic industrial and financial axis, which gave rise to the Christian West concept, and as we shall see, that is the seed concept for what became NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We're now going to turn to an excellent book, one of the best books, in my opinion, ever written about the U.S. intelligence agencies, the U.S. intelligence system. And this book is excellent in particular because it goes into the connections between Wall Street and the fascist powers of Europe, Nazi Germany in particular, and it talks about how some of the main people involved in this transatlantic industrial and financial axis went on to become key operatives in the U.S. intelligence system, the CIA in particular, but also the Office of Strategic Services. This book goes into the Galen organization as well, and although it's very expensive, I would recommend it to any listener who is serious about studying not only the U.S. intelligence apparatus, but the history of the 20th century in general. This book is entitled The Old Boys, subtitled The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA. It was authored by Burton Hirsch, H-E-R-S-H, published in hardcover by Charles Scribner & Sons, New York, and it's copyrighted 1992. And again, it's an excellent read. I can't recommend this book too strongly. What we're going to begin looking at is one of the central figures in this particular installment of Radio Free America number 37, one of the most important figures in 20th century history and 20th century American history as well, a deeply evil individual, a person who fortunately is no longer with us physically, but an individual whose work, unfortunately, is still very much with us, or the result of it. That person is Alan Welch Dulles, a senior partner in Sullivan & Cromwell, one of the major foreign policy law firms on Wall Street, an individual who became head of the Bern, Switzerland OSS office during World War II, who later on went on to become director of the Central Intelligence Agency, while his brother, also a senior partner in Sullivan & Cromwell, John Foster Dulles, was Secretary of State. Alan Dulles later was fired by President Kennedy for lying to him about the Bay of Pigs. He then served on the Warren Commission, which was supposedly investigating President Kennedy's death. And the first thing we're going to look at, and by the way, the deep involvement of Sullivan and Cromwell and both Dulles brothers in this transatlantic industrial and financial axis, this was discussed at great length in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, which I play every Memorial Day weekend here on KFJC. And that archive show can be obtained from Archives on Audio. Of Alan Dulles and his views concerning Nazism, and we're talking here in 1932, Burton Hirsch writes as follows in The Old Boys. In May of 1932, Alan wrote Foster, that's Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, beginning again, in May of 1932, Alan wrote Foster that, quote, "With the Prussian election, it seems to me that the question of the participation of the Hitler element in the Prussian government and then in the Reich government will again be agitated. Personally, I hope that their participation will be worked out, as I feel that any government in France would be very reluctant to enter into any far-reaching agreements with the German government which was not in some way underwritten or approved by the Hitler element." Unquote. And that by way of indicating that not only was Alan Dulles and so many of the industrialists and financiers involved with the fascist powers of Europe from a business standpoint. For some of them, it was just business. As the Germans say, Geheist ist Geheist, business is business. But many of them were also ardently pro-fascist because they saw fascism, again, as the antidote not only to the Marxist Soviet Union, but also to the threat of socialism in other countries as well. Skipping ahead in The Old Boys, we're now going to look at a very important chapter called Buried Blissfully in Switzerland. Unfortunately, Alan Dulles was not buried in Switzerland. We all would be much better off if he had been literally buried in Switzerland or someplace else, but he was very much alive at this particular point in history and very active, and the effects of his activities are very much with us in calendar year 1992. The Donovan alluded to here is William Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence agency. Donovan himself, a very prominent Wall Street lawyer, involved with many of these same interests, notably the Morgan Group. Hirsch writes in this chapter, One find of Donovan's who regularly brought hackles up around the district, that's Washington, D.C., was his New York branch manager, Alan Dulles. By the way, branch manager here, it refers to OSS, it's not his New York branch manager. One find of Donovan's who regularly brought hackles up around the district was his New York branch manager, Alan Dulles. Eleanor Roosevelt would complain in a memo to FDR that Alan, a recurring personage in, quote, Bill Donovan's outfit, unquote, was, quote, closely tied up with the Schroeder Bank that is likely to be representative of the underground Nazi interests after the war, one of, quote, a great many people who are pretty close to the business side, unquote. Note here that Eleanor Roosevelt was noting Alan Dulles' connection to, among other Nazi interests, the Schroeder Bank that we looked at great length in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast from May of 1980. But as she notes here, the Schroeder Bank figures to become a major element in the post-World War II Nazi underground, whose formation was already obviously envisioned at that juncture. Now, again, we just finished looking at Eleanor Roosevelt's prognostications concerning the role of the Schroeder Bank in the post-World War II Nazi underground and Alan Dulles' connections to that, among other Nazi business interests. What we're going to be looking at now are some of the activities of Alan Dulles while he was, quote, buried, unquote, in Switzerland. Again, Alan Dulles was head of the Bern, Switzerland office of the OSS, and that neutral country was the site of numerous negotiations being conducted by Alan Dulles and other representatives of the Western Allies with people from the Third Reich who were not only part and parcel to this transatlantic industrial and financial axis that I've been discussing for so long on this, or for so many years on this program, but who were also serving as not only diplomatic representatives, but espionage agents for the Third Reich. Now, again, I'm going to reiterate something I discussed in the introduction of the broadcast. The Third Reich's national security establishment and intelligence system, just like our own intelligence system, was not monolithic. There were factions within it. One of the most important Third Reich intelligence agencies was the Abwehr, headed up for much of the war by Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, last name C-A-N-A-R-I-S. The Abwehr tended to be more identified with the traditional German officer corps, with the German aristocracy, and with the Junkers, the traditional German landholders. It obviously worked very closely with the more notorious elements of Nazism. At the same time, there were divisions within it. It should also be noted that the officer corps had many strategic differences with Adolf Hitler. Early on, the head of the Abwehr, the aforementioned Canaris, foresaw the defeat of the Third Reich. He also personally, according to accounts, was not necessarily contemptuous of, but quite horrified by certain aspects of the Third Reich, and partly because of that, but also largely to hedge his bets, because he foresaw early on the military defeat of the Third Reich coming. He had begun to make contact with the Great Britain and the United States through people who were at the same time diplomatic representatives and spies, and who at the same time were deeply immersed in the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that we're looking at here. It should also be noted that the world of espionage is, to say the least, murky. One thing I do not get too immersed in is the dynamic of what one could call spy versus spy. When it comes to the operation of double and triple agents, those are very murky waters indeed, and oftentimes the intelligence agencies themselves are not completely familiar with exactly who's working for who. And although many of these members of the Canaris group, again, part and parcel to some of the business interests which spanned the Atlantic and operated both in the United States as well as the Third Reich, although many of them were making contact with the West, although many of them were channeling information to both the British and American intelligence services, many of them were also still functioning as spies for Nazi Germany, as well as touchdown points, feelers, for establishing exactly the kind of link between the German industrialists and financiers and their American and British counterparts, which the German industrialists sought to do in order to preserve their interests after World War II. As we shall see, as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, this was done, and we're going to take a look now at how representatives of the Canaris group, part of this transatlantic axis, were in touch with Alan Dulles, and also how, eventually, these links between the, quote, German resistance, and this belongs in quotes here, they were plotting against Hitler, but only because they sought to preserve the Reich by ridding the Reich of some of the more notorious elements, i.e. Hitler and the SS, and the Germans, Third Reich's prejudicial views. As we shall see, ultimately, this German underground, this, quote, resistance, unquote, and we should never lose sight of the quotes, their activities were well known to the SS and to Heinrich Himmler and to a man named Walter Schellenberg, who was in charge of Amt 6, the Bureau 6 of the Sicherheitsdienst, that's the SS intelligence service. Specifically, Schellenberg was in charge with foreign intelligence for the SD. They were aware of the activities of this, quote, resistance, unquote, associated with the Canaris group. They also used some of the same people to effect direct contacts between representatives for the SS and people like Alan Dulles and the business interests that he represented. Now, the two most important names we're going to look at here are a fellow named Gero von Schulze-Gevernitz, that's spelled G-E-R-O, Schulze is S-C-H-U-L-Z-E, G-A-E-V-E-R-N-I-T-Z, and also a fellow called Prince von Hohenlohe. Specifically, Prince von Hohenlohe is spelled, or his full name, is Prince Max Egon zu Hohenlohe Langenberg. That's E-G-O-N-Z-U-H-O-H-E-N-L-O-H-E hyphen L-A-N-G-E-N-B-U-R-G. Those are the two most important names. Gero von Gevernitz, a representative of the Canaris group, also, though, an individual who effected contacts between representatives of the Sicherheitsdienst and the SS and Alan Dulles and the OSS. Now, von Hohenlohe was specifically a representative acting as a go-between between the SS and Alan Dulles and the interests he represented. Some other names you were going to want to pay attention here to. Again, the Schroeder banking interests, the Schroeder banking family, was part and parcel to this transatlantic axis that I've been speaking about for so many years. They were British, American, and German branches of this. Take note of the Stinnes family. Hugo Stinnes was a major German industrialist and backer of Adolf Hitler, who also had extensive holdings in the United States. He was touched on in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Note also the Warburgs, again with German, British, and American branches. And we took a look at the Warburgs in connection with the IG Farben company, in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and an addendum to it that I did last Memorial Day. Also take note of a fellow named Edward von Waetjen, W-A-E-T-G-J-E-N, a German industrialist who married into the Rockefeller family. And as we shall see, Gero von Gevernitz and Alan Dulles had collaborated in setting up a company called Schilge Rumor, S-A-S-C-H-I-L-D-G-E, R-U-M-O-H-R, and this was financed. The financing for this was arranged by Alan Dulles through J. Henry Schroeder Company, and this was used by the Germans for circumventing the British blockade. Note also that Gero von Gevernitz, the friend of man, was involved with overseeing the Stinnes interests in Switzerland and Germany as well. And again, Hugo Stinnes, an ardent backer of Hitler, and another main operative in this transatlantic industrial and financial axis. Waetjen and von Gevernitz served as Canaris men, again, representatives of the Abwehr, in making contact with and working with Alan Dulles, and this should all be seen against the background of the passage that we looked at from The Nazis Go Underground, in which the German industrialists sought to formally, at least, divorce themselves from Nazism, this by way of surviving the collapse of the Third Reich and maintaining their operations not only in Germany but around the world. And one of the central elements in that was to continue to operate with many of their cohorts in other countries such as Germany, or such as the United States and Britain. With Alan Dulles and his activities with Gero von Gevernitz and some of the other people that we're talking about, Burton Hirsch writes as follows in The Old Boys. Waiting for Dulles' arrival in Bern was Gero von Schulze-Gevernitz. Gevernitz represented a hybrid, the son of a liberal Quaker Reichstag politician whom Dulles met as early as 1916, and a sophisticated Jewish mother. The preceding generation's refinement came through in Gevernitz's distinctive widow's peak, his ready, deferential smile. Gero's sister married Edmund Stinnes, S-T-I-N-N-E-S, older son of the precocious Hitler backer and mega-capitalist Hugo Stinnes. Edmund had been excluded from the Stinnes iron and coal combine and bided his time with academics on the Haverford faculty. By the way, Haverford College in Pennsylvania is a small, exclusive American undergraduate institution. As the 20s proceeded, Gevernitz jumped back and forth between the Ruhr and Wall Street. He acquired an economics doctorate and styled himself an, quote, investment counselor, unquote. Reinforced by his conciliatory manners, contacts from the Warburg Bank in Hamburg to the vaults of Basel, and impressive bilingualism, Gevernitz landed a job in Manhattan as an associate of the Equity Corporation. One of his fellows there was Ellery Huntington, H-U-N-T-I-N-G-T-O-N, a confidant of Donovan's. Gevernitz maintained a close transatlantic association with the German financial expert Eduard von Wechen, whose mother was American and himself married into a branch of the Rockefeller family. In 1936, Gevernitz took out U.S. citizenship papers. In 1939, Gevernitz's parents resettled in Switzerland. Giro, still in and out a great deal, now made his base in Bern, from where he watched over his brother-in-law's property near Ascona. When Alan Dulles appeared with a letter of introduction from Huntington, the gently spoken, beautifully brushed Giro, a bit past 40, impressed Dulles as ideally suited to function as his surrogate throughout the German-speaking emigre community. It is certainly conceivable that Dulles wasn't up to speed on Gevernitz's checkered involvements. Giro was a finagler by instinct, a high-style commission peddler. As late as October of 1941, Gevernitz, now bear in mind he was an American citizen at this point, as late as October of 1941, Gevernitz listed his occupation in Switzerland as an agent for Schilge Rumor Incorporated, a New York dummy corporation known subsequently as Transmares, T-R-A-N-S-M-A-R-E-S, the financing for which Dulles himself had expedited through J. Henry Schroeder and identified by the Department of Justice as a front for circumventing the British blockade with strategic materials for embattled Germany. Giro pocketed a 30,000 franc payoff from Maritime Suisse for inducing North German Lloyd to permit the cross-registration of a vessel from Finnish to Swiss flag, then sanitized the money in Lisbon through the notorious E.V.D. White, W-I-G-H-T. He continued to oversee Stinnes holdings in Germany and Switzerland. These involvements were obligatory, Gevernitz would explain to Dulles, quote, as additional cover for my trips to Germany and for my contacts with Germans, unquote. He required commercial bona fides to mask his services to British intelligence. Then, after war broke out, he rummaged widely at the behest of Brigadier General Barnwell Legge, L-E-G-G-E, the U.S. military attaché in Bern. Gevernitz had indeed rendered, Legge later wrote, quote, most valuable service by gaining contact with prominent German industrialists and businessmen who visited Switzerland. Now, again, Gevernitz here, it should be recognized, was not just working with British and American intelligence services. It in fact appears that he was a triple agent, dispatched to Switzerland as a German diplomatic representative. He was spying for both U.S. and Britain, but he was apparently a triple agent because he was also spying for the Canaris Group. Continuing, Hirsch writes, whose agent was Giro? A confidential post-war memo refers to an interrogation of Dr. Wolfgang Kraul, K-R-A-U-E-L, until the Reich collapsed the German consul at Geneva. Kraul had unhesitatingly ticked off the roster of, quote, former Canaris men, unquote, in Switzerland. Hans Bernd Gisevius, B-E-R-N-D-G-I-S-E-V-I-U-S, Max von Engelbrechten, E-N-G-E-L-B-R-E-C-H-T-E-N, Graf Ausberg, A-U-E-R-S-P-E-R-G, von der Mühle, and it's not explained who his first name was, and specified that, quote, Canaris sent these men here to make contact with the Americans. They were ordered by Canaris to work through von Gevernitz. That last sentence again, all of these above men, and note here Hans Bernd Gisevius, G-I-S-E-V-I-U-S, very important name, we'll come back to him, but note here again, this from the former German consul at Geneva, quote, Canaris sent these men here to make contact with the Americans. They were ordered by Canaris to work through von Gevernitz. Canaris took this step because he early became pessimistic about the war's outcome. Eddie Wechen and Theodor Strunk, S-T-R-U-N-C-K, too, joined the Canaris delegation in Switzerland. Years later, congratulating Dulles on his appointment as CIA director, an intimate of Canaris wrote Allen, quote, I have known since 1942 how highly Canaris esteemed you. Even at that time, Canaris ordered me to align myself with Dulles as soon as possible. I was also in touch with one of your most capable co-workers through a very clever banker. I was able to obtain from your staff without any difficulty some information very important for us. I would prefer to say nothing more about this now," unquote. So obviously, these Canaris people, they were in contact with the Americans and British, and were also channeling the Americans and British some valuable information. There were divisions, and rather sharp ones, between the Canaris group and, say, the Sicherheitsdienst and the SS and Hitler and the more venal elements of the Nazi Party. Yet at the same time, what we're looking at here is a, quote, German resistance, which was, in fact, to form the with their American counterparts, such as Alan Dulles, the Christian West concept, which is the seed concept for NATO, and which, as we shall see, permitted the survival of the more venal elements that Canaris himself was, at least up to a point, opposed to. And that permitted the survival, literally the survival of the Third Reich, although not in an overt territorial sense, and that is part and parcel to the overall thesis, how the U.S. lost the Second World War. So obviously this intimate of Canaris who wrote Alan Dulles is saying, I was able to obtain from your staff without any difficulty some information very important for us. I would prefer to say nothing more about this. Now, again, the whole question of double and triple agents is a very murky one, and these are waters that are very, very difficult to peer through. So exactly who is zooming who here is to a certain extent a matter of conjecture, and I doubt will ever be settled formally. But the important point here is to note the contacts between the Canaris group and Alan Dulles, the fact that the Canaris agents who were in touch with Dulles were part and parcel to the transatlantic industrial and financial axis, and as we shall see, this anti-Hitler, anti-SS, though pro-right group, its existence was well known to the SS, to Heinrich Himmler, to Walter Schellenberg of the SD, and ultimately some of the same people such as von Gebernitz and Hans Bernd Gisevius were used to introduce Alan Dulles to Prince Max von Hohenlohe, who specifically was representing the SS, and this ultimately gave rise to the Christian West concept. Continuing here with Burton Hirsch's account. Messengers from the subtle, lisping little admiral who presided over German military intelligence, they came as envoys, confident of their welcome. Dulles's abiding link with what he subsequently dubbed the German underground was the chronically malcontented Hans Bernd Gisevius, that vast, floppy, wall-eyed Prussian handed along from rightist security expert Rudolf Diels to Hjalmar Schacht to the elusive Admiral Canaris himself. Diels is D-I-E-L-S. Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht is S-C-H-A-C-H-T. His first name, H-J-A-L-M-A-R. Continuing. A confirmed Stahlhelm reactionary with financial ties to the Lutheran Synod, quote, the fanaticism of Gisevius, unquote, proved instrumental. Brüning had warned Dulles in subverting a decisive faction of the Nationalist Party between 1931 and 1933. Gisevius had hung on as a Gestapo lawyer before Canaris parked him as a vice consul in Zurich. So again, Gisevius, even though working for Canaris, is also SS, because the Gestapo was part of the SS. By the way, the SS hierarchy was grouped around what is known as the RSHA, the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, that is literally translates as the High Bureau of Reich Security. That was composed into two basic factions. One was the SD, or Sicherheitsdienst, the SS Intelligence Service, and the other was the SIPO, or Sicherheitspolizei. SIPO is S-I-P-O. That, in turn, was divided into the KRIPO, K-R-I-P-O, or which was short for Kriminalpolizei, and the Gestapo, which was short for Geheime Staatspolizei, Secret State Police. So again, the RSHA divided into the SD and the SIPO, Security Police, and that in turn divided into the KRIPO and Gestapo. Continuing here. There, Canaris appointed Gisevius his representative to Madame Halina Zymanska, H-A-L-I-N-A-S-Z-Y-M-A-N-S-K-A, the widowed Polish cutout through whom his military intelligence apparatus selectively leaked political insights to Vandenhoevel and the SIS, that Special Intelligence Service. Dulles was soon sneaking the immense, baby-faced German into the drawing room at 23 Herrengasse, H-E-R-R-E-N-G-A-S-S-E. They arrived at an understanding to keep the agile American up to date on the succession of plots on Hitler's life. Hopefully, through his purported access as, quote, President Roosevelt's personal representative, unquote, Dulles might benefit both their nations by conveying to Washington's ruling circles the settlement the insurgents were preparing to tender to the West. The last sentence again, because it's a key one. Hopefully, through his purported access as, quote, President Roosevelt's personal representative, unquote, Dulles might benefit both their nations by conveying to Washington's ruling circles the settlement the insurgents were preparing to tender the West. They'd view Dulles's portfolio as representation for the as representative for the Enskilda Bank of Stockholm, Allen and his They'd review Dulles's portfolio as representation for the Enskilda Bank of Stockholm. Allen and his brother had argued for the Wallenbergs as late as 1940, when Marcus Wallenberg appeared in New York and attempted to immunize the American-held certificates of the Robert Bosch Company. Wallenberg is W-A-L-L-E-N-B-E-R-G, and Bosch is B-O-S-C-H. Later on, Allen pleaded with Marcus to publicize at least a selective reference to, quote, your contacts and to my contacts with the resistance group prior to the July 20th putsch. Unless there are some local reasons at your end, of which I cannot judge here, it might be well to get this out in the open a little more. One thing I would note is that the Wallenberg family, Marcus and Jacob Wallenberg, were head of the SKF, that was a giant ball bearing conglomerate, giant ball bearing manufacturer, which supplied ball bearings to all sides, had a complete monopoly on ball bearing manufacture during the Second World War. They supplied them to all of the major combatants.